Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, I try each episode to post some thoughts to help get a conversation started about hammering out a viable, a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. And as always, I invite your comments and questions, which I often integrate into future episodes, but we'll definitely gather together at the end of this project when I turn this podcast into a book. Now, in this second section of the project, we're asking this question: does religion have anything to offer our society's current need for a viable curriculum for sex education? Now, in these first few episodes, before we could talk about religion's gift, we have been talking about what went wrong. And so today I want to begin this next episode, the title of which is Recovering a Healthy Christian Sexuality. Where do we go from here? Now, for the last several episodes, we have undertaken an inquiry into these toxic instincts that Western Christianity holds around sexuality. And we did so to be forewarned, because we are inheritors of a long legacy of toxic religious instincts, we Christians. And they're old instincts. They're deep. They're sneaky. They worm their way into our thinking under the cover of darkness, and they shape-shift into all kinds of seemingly innocuous thoughts, but are deeply toxic. When impulses are as old as ours, they do run deep. They're driven underground or not, they still continue to wait in the wings, ready to morph into novel but still toxic contours. Even when we get innovative and fresh, they remain lethal, sneaking into our sexual narrative without warning. This is the work that's set before our generation, to uncover and to assess instincts that run so deep that we often don't even see them. There is a truism that you find what you're looking for. Now, since I started this project, I can't tell you how many times I've heard those ancient toxic instincts show up in conversations with Christian people. Now, I'm sure it's happening because I'm having a lot of these kinds of conversations. I'm talking about it more often because I'm doing this project. But as I do, there those instincts are, and they're there all the time. As long as they remain unseen, they silently affect us. They silently shape us. They tell us in subtle ways that sex is dirty and that lady sex is the dirtiest of all. Now, the problematic nature of our ancient Christian heritage around sexuality really came to a head in the 1960s. That's when Western society as a whole began to look outside the church for wisdom and understanding about how to live a good life. That's when the exodus from church life began, and that exodus continues to today. And a lot of that had to do with the church's view, the church's ideas around sex, the toxic ideas we've been exploring these last few episodes. The 60s were a tumultuous decade, and sexual change was in the air. Few people knew about the church history we've been discussing. Nobody knew about Clement or Augustine or how the Platonic worldview sent things sideways. But even so, the social conversation began to recognize that the church had some baggage around sex. After World War II and the post-war baby boom, people were taking a fresh look at human sexuality. Freud's insights had filtered into popular understanding by then. The Kinsey Report came out in the late 40s and the early 50s, and sexuality became fair game for polite conversation. By the time we got to the 60s, Masters and Johnson were publishing very specific studies about how our sexuality works. The curtain of sexual taboo was being pulled back. And as a society, we began to understand that sexuality is naturally wired right into our brains, right into our bodies. We began to see that eroticism is normal and natural and part of being human, and that human sexuality is very much like animal sexuality, and we begin to understand that animal sexuality is built right into everyday normalness, the same way that eating food is built into normalness or growing hair. Our sexual attractions, our sexual drives, the sexual physical responses that our bodies undergo, these are an intrinsic part of being human, again, healthy and normal and wholesome and beneficial. In many ways, our social conversation began to circle back to the Hebrew view of sexuality that we looked at a few episodes ago. And when the conversation began to make this shift toward normalizing sexuality, the dirty sex undercurrent that was in the church, Christianity's rules and taboo approach to sexuality, that began to be much more out of step with the cultural conversation. As society was upending our shared thinking about sexuality, We didn't really have the discussion in historical terms. Little was said about the Platonic worldview or Clement or Augustine or even restoring human instincts. Instead, folks just begin to realize sex is not dirty. Human sexuality is not taboo. The church is wrong. Which, you can imagine, the church didn't like hearing. As a critical mass of people in our society begin to shift their thinking about sexuality, most churches, conservative institutions by nature, didn't really engage the discussion. They didn't really use that historical opportunity to rethink some of our core assumptions. For the most part, church did not take up the challenge and did not go back into our own history, did not make a thorough self-examination to seek out the error of our ways. Rather, for the most part, church conserved the old ways. That's what conservative institutions do. They hold on to the old ways. Church folk held on to the way things had always been said and talked about and done. Now, from a long view historical perspective, holding on to the old ways, to the tried and true ways, holding on to the ancient and the proven and the reliable wisdom, this is a helpful instinct. It helps us stay steady during times of tumult. It's a very helpful role that the church has often played through history, but sometimes, at certain moments in history, the conservative role is really just a backhanded way to shirk the hard work of an internal self-assessment, the hard work that would help us adapt to a changing world, which in this instance, it appears we did. The sexual revolution of the 60s could have been an invitation to the church to engage some deep rethinking, to see the toxins that had crept into our sexual narrative. But instead, we let the challenge devolve into a battle, an us versus them battle. Instead of introspection, the church started fighting the righteous fight. And as happens when people start to fuss, we thought of us as us. And we thought of us as the righteous and the holy ones. And we thought of them as them. And we framed them as the degenerate, reprobate, the godless ones. And here's the thing that happens when people go into battle mode. Listening and learning and growing and reflection and wise and considered responses, all that stuff tends to go out the window. And that's what began to happen in the church in the 60s. Society came to understand something about sexuality that church folk weren't seeing. Society awakened to the non-taboo healthiness of human sexuality, and the church got a little bit reactionary. Reactionary, that's what happens when people feel threatened. It was a decade when the church's long-standing dominant social position was being threatened. We had once been the guardians and the arbiters of wisdom for living, and in particular, we had been the guardians of sexual propriety. But as we lost our preferred position in society, we felt it. And our sense of loss evoked a threat response. And we did what threatened people do. We entrenched. We doubled down on the position we held when we were in charge. We didn't revisit. We didn't reconsider our ideas. We did preach harder. And we did preach louder. But mostly what we did was just keep pulling out an old trump card that we had been playing for centuries. We kept playing the God said trump card. God said you should do this with your body and you should not do that. God said. Now, for a long time, that had been a really effective strategy. For a long time, we told our young people the right way to think and act with their sexuality. We preached the importance of committed, loving relationships. We told them to wait for marriage. We told them to exercise self-control because we told them that's what God says. And it's not that what we said was bad for them. In fact, we had some good ideas, but our young people stopped listening because our God says trump card had worked well so well for so long, we'd gotten away with it for so long, we didn't see it when it shifted to becoming arrogance or hubris. We didn't see it when our own minds could not imagine that we might have gotten things wrong. So what we didn't do was examine our bad ideas. And now, in this current generation, when it is becoming increasingly clear that society's approach to sexuality is not working either, now that the experiment that was launched in the 60s has devolved and become hurtful and harmful, now that we have indulgence without restraint and that our sexual norms are leaving a wake of pain and suffering like we saw in the first episode, Now that we're having to scramble to protect our women and our college campuses and our military and even our children, it's becoming clear that the absence of any kind of sexual norm is not as healthy as we imagined. This is a moment in history when religion does have something to offer. It is a time when we could go back and save the baby out of all that bathwash. We could give the gift of our ancient wisdom. However, society isn't listening to the church anymore, and the church isn't listening to society. And as a result, both sides are kind of suffering an imbalance. The church's imbalance has devolved into too much control. Society's imbalance has devolved into not enough control. And neither side is engaged in much introspection about their error. Neither side is looking at the other's wisdom. Christians have trouble embracing a healthy, full embrace of sexual passion. And society has trouble assessing restraint and how people suffer when we fail with some forms of restraint. But neither side can hear the other one. Each sees the other as an adversary, and neither one is able to access the other. And neither can see how the other sees what we do not. If we could hear one another, we could inform one another's blind spots. We could find our way forward into a healthier sexual practice. We could find healthier ways to situate eroticism in the broader framework of health of human love. Both sides need to be informed by the other. Both sides need to undertake an honest self-examination and see their own toxic beliefs and faulty strategies and informed by one another to be able to rethink those instincts and step back from them. Our part in this, as religious people, or the purpose of this podcast, is to invite religion to that kind of self-examination. A cornerstone of religion's ancient wisdom is to insist that erotic sexuality works best when it is positioned within the larger, multifaceted sexual journey, the full journey that we looked at in the first section of this podcast. It is a wisdom that points to a great deal of upfront arranging, upfront work that is necessary to help us thrive on the sexual journey. Religion teaches that there are a lot of things that need to be in place before we jump into bed. And ours are tried and true strategies for getting those things put into place. So we advocate for time and energy and focus and attention before we jump into bed. Religion wisdom treats sexuality more holistically. We insist that eroticism can't be divorced from deep psychological and emotional processes, and we insist that it not be divorced from relationship. We insist that sexual pleasure divorced from a larger human context ends up being short-lived and, in fact, ends up damaging the deeper parts of our humanity, which, in practical terms, means that we advocate for that upfront work before sexual activity. We advocate for upfront work that takes energy and planning and time. We advocate for that upfront work to be in place so that our sexual journeys will be healthy ones. So this is an ancient wisdom. It's a deep and a powerful wisdom. However, the toxic instincts that we've been looking at these last episodes have kept us from being able to offer that wisdom to our young people. A young man was talking to me the other day about pornography, and he had decided that that was no longer a healthy practice for him, and we were discussing ways to sidestep it in daily life, which is not an easy thing if you own a computer. As we were talking about why he had made this decision, what he said was really interesting. This young man grew up in church. He'd been to all the youth group discussions about sex. His family taught him the religious sex curriculum. And I'm sure all these sources had influenced him in some way, but he didn't cite a single one of them for the reason he's decided to forego pornography. He didn't base his decision on anything in the Bible. He didn't base it on anything he learned at church or at home or from a youth leader. Instead, what he said was this: "I have seen enough TED Talks to know that porn isn't good for me." I thought that was great. "I've seen enough TED Talks to know that porn isn't good for me. It's not something that I want shaping how my brain works." Now, for religion to regain its voice, to answer the question of this episode, where do we go from here? This is where we go. This is how we will make our case. If we are going to be heard, if we're going to be able to offer the contribution that we have to make, we're going to need to present our ancient wisdom in non-religious language, in a non-religious framework, because religion has grown toxic. we're going to need to understand and be informed by and draw from the wisdom of biology and psychology and sociology and history and social analysis. We're going to need to make our case for the accumulated wisdom of religion without pulling out the trump card, God says. We're going to have to make our case for the accumulated wisdom of religion without using religious language. So in the remaining episodes of this project, you're going to notice that I purposely downplay religious language, because to use that language would be to risk joining the chorus that young people are dismissing. To use it is to advocate for these subconscious dirty sex instincts, or rule-driven taboos, or divine decrees. Now, we do have a wisdom about the fullness of sexuality. And it is a wisdom that can save people the pain that so many suffer who are following society's current sexual curriculum. However, experience indicates that a religious approach with our young people simply doesn't work anymore. I believe our best approach today is to articulate our religious wisdom in a language and a framework that they can relate to. So, as religious people, here's our to-do list. First, we have to undertake some serious rethinking of these ancient and toxic instincts. We have to be doubly on guard for the ways that taboo sneaks into our thinking about sex. We have to celebrate the animal goodness and the healthiness and the normalness of our sexual drives and instincts, and we have to challenge those venerated instincts that come from our own tradition. That's first. Second, we have to distill out the wisdom that religion has accumulated the centuries and talk about it without resorting to religious language or religious pressure. That's the reason we've spent these last few episodes focusing on Western Christianity's historical blind spots. Because we bring to the table a demanding sexual journey. We set before the sexual path some upfront difficulties, which no one will be able to hear if we continue to lack credibility. Who would be willing to pay the upfront price if that price was being advocated for by someone without credibility? The challenge before us is to regain our moral authority. The challenge before us is to undertake a fearless self-assessment and then to actively engage our society and to make our case in a language that can be heard. So that's what we'll be doing in the next several episodes. I hope to make the case for religion having a place at the table in this cultural discussion, but to do it without resorting to religious language or religious dictates. So we'll pick up there in the next episode. But as always, what are you thinking about? What's stirring up in your heart? Let me know.